On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America, you lost, shouted Al-Qaeda conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui in the courtroom yesterday after a jury of 9 men and 3 women rejected the death penalty for Moussaoui and sent him to life in prison. To many, the verdict looked more like a victory. American justice observed, a bitter, angry man treated with equanimity and put away. President Bush praised the quality of mercy in the jury's decision. But in the larger conflict with Al-Qaeda, the battle in which Zacharias Moussaoui was a small fish and 9/11 was an earthquake, the state of play is less clear and less public. Up next on Point, the Moussaoui sentence and the real state of battle with Al-Qaeda. Joining me now from Washington is Brian Bennett. He's a correspondent for Time magazine and covered the Moussaoui trial from start to finish. Brian, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be on the show.
So your sense, as the jury goes out, that we read different reports here. Some say that in the courtroom yesterday there was great surprise that they did not embrace the death penalty. Was that your sense of how onlookers felt when their ruling came?
There was surprise, I think, among a lot of the 9/11 families. I think they really showed that it was not the verdict that they were necessarily expecting. But after... as we saw when they came and spoke with reporters outside the courthouse afterward, upon reflection, many of the families, some of the families were disappointed at the verdict, but many of the families recognized that it was our justice system at work and actually showed a tremendous amount of restraint on the part of the American people.
Now, the spokesman said yesterday, this was Edward Adams speaking outside the court, that the jurors unanimously agreed that he had entered the country for the purpose of gaining knowledge necessary to kill as many Americans as possible. But they were not unanimous in finding that his actions resulted in the deaths of the nearly, 3,000 who were killed on September 11th. What were the main mitigating factors that you think steered them away from the death penalty, Brian?
Well, certainly the rejection of that aggravating factor that was the key to the prosecution's case, that Moussaoui's actions would have been, and the fact that he did not talk with FBI agents, was responsible for the death of 3,000 people on September 11th, that he had knowledge in his hands that could have prevented those attacks.
The jury was not convinced of that.
They rejected that. For the mitigating factors, we know from the jury verdict forms that they took into account that Moussaoui had a unstable family, had spent time in orphanages, had hostile relations with his mother. They took into account that his father had a bad temper, had emotionally abused Zacharias Moussaoui, and some of the jurors took into account that he might have been subject of racism because of his Moroccan ancestry in France as a youngster, and. Basically, the argument that the defense was making was that this led him into a life of jihad. And those were some of the mitigating factors that the jurors were looking at. I think the most important thing is that the rejection of the prosecution argument that Zacharias Moussaoui was responsible for the death of 3,000 on the day of September 11th.
So he came to wreak havoc, they agreed, but whether or not he was responsible or really related to the deaths on September 11th, and then these mitigating circumstances, that's a lot of empathy you're describing there for someone connected, however generally, to 9/11, to look back to his childhood, dysfunctional immigrant Moroccan family in France, to his time in orphanages, to his mother and father. I mean, that seems like sounds like a very contemporary American jury way of looking at a man in the middle of one of the most heinous cases of attack on the U.S. in history.
Well, watching this from the outside, it does. It looked to me like Zacharias Moussaoui had a death wish. Like, you know, he was purposely trying to derail his trial so that he would get the death penalty and be executed. Mm-hmm. And the jurors really rejected that argument. At least they did on paper. They said no jurors found that life in prison would be more severe than death for Moussaoui. No jurors found that death by execution would be part of his jihad. And no jurors found that his death by execution would make him a martyr, even though that does seem to be an obvious conclusion that could be made from a lot of Zacharias Moussaoui's comments in court.
It's fascinating the subtlety of these issues that the jury spoke to in their final report. The defense attorney, Gerald Zirkin, tried to persuade them to not give him the death penalty because he wanted it. He said he wants you to sentence him to death. He's baiting you into it. He came to America to die in jihad, and you're his last chance. You're saying the jury said that's not at play in our decision here.
That's what they said. And I think with the outcome, just as being an observer and having no special knowledge mm-hmm. in the psychology of Zacharias Moussaoui, but I think this was probably the worst possible outcome for him. And just after listening for weeks at his comments in court, I am convinced that he wanted to bait the jury into executing him and sentencing him to death. And life in prison is probably the worst punishment he could have gotten.
He'll be in solitary confinement in a supermax prison in all likelihood in Colorado. No chance of parole, no chance of getting out before he dies. What was your sense of the man that emerged over these weeks? Brian, you were there. We weren't. Is he crazy?
My sense, and again, I don't have any special information. I'm not an expert in psychology or anything, but my sense is that he was not crazy, that his outbursts were a calculated rejection of the American justice system, were grandstanding, were using his platform to say as many hateful things as he could, and just my analysis as an observer was that he wanted to bait the jury into coming up with a death sentence.
In your sense, on balance, of family survivor reaction, I know it was all over the map, but do you think that in general, after it's all said and done here, after everything has been heard, were the majority of family members feeling satisfied with what the jury came back with?
Just from the reaction outside the courtroom yesterday from the family members, I'd say yes, the majority were. Maybe not satisfied is maybe the wrong word, but at peace with the jury's decision. They recognized that the American justice system was allowed to work, that it seemed to work properly, and there were certainly family members who were disappointed and unhappy. But by and large, I think upon reflection, most of the family members were happy that the trial was over and that they got to say their piece and that a verdict was issued.
No martyrdom for Zacharias Moussaoui, but a very long time, in all likelihood, till the end of his life in a supermax prison cell in Colorado. Brian Bennett with Time Magazine. Brian, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, happy to be on the show, Tom.
Joining me now to look at the broader battle with al-Qaeda is Josh Meyer, terrorism correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Josh, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome, Tom.
Remind us what kind of player Zacharias Moussaoui was in the big al-Qaeda scheme. How small a fish, how marginal?
Well, I think the term bit player is probably applicable here. I mean, what I was most struck by in the trial, and I followed it closely, was some of the statements that they introduced into evidence from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other senior al-Qaeda leaders who said that they thought Zacharias Moussaoui was very unstable and that he was not able to be trusted and that he was sent to the United States for a mission, but that they did not trust him with some of the most pertinent details, if any pertinent details, of the September 11th attack.
So this is a very high al-Qaeda official speaking, I guess this is what he said under interrogation,
right,
about one of his own guys, but one that they didn't put a lot of confidence in.
Right. It was fascinating. He said that Osama bin Laden had put pressure, in a sense, on the plot mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, to use Zacharias Moussaoui. In fact, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had tried to take Zacharias Moussaoui out of the plot. I think he didn't even want to return him to the United States and was told to do so. And so he was sort of grudgingly using Moussaoui. But even then, he, to sort of cover his bases, did not share a lot of information with Moussaoui, if you believe Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was his top lieutenant in the 9/11 plot.
So this kind of seething jihadist message that that Moussaoui was shouting out in the courtroom, does that suggest this is not representative of the kind of mindset of jihadis in general in al-Qaeda, or at least others of them are more buttoned down?
Well, clearly some of the ones that I'm familiar with are much more sort of cunning and calculated, and some of these guys are very, very smart. They're very, very well educated. As you know, some of the hijackers in the 9/11 plot, especially the pilots, were college-trained. Some of them were engineers. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed himself is an engineer. I think, the perception of Zacharias Moussaoui was he was sort of one of the kooky sort of wingnut type loose cannons in Al-Qaeda. So even in an organization like Al-Qaeda, he really didn't seem to fit in. I mean, they want soldiers who practice operational security, who don't call people on their cell phones and don't say things. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed made it very clear in his interrogation reports that when he told Zacharias Moussaoui to come to the United States, to not call him on his cell phone, to not talk about, you know, trying to take flight training or mention airplanes. And he said that the first thing Zacharias Moussaoui did when he got to the United States was called him and started talking about that very same thing.
Josh, I'm interested in your sort of big take on how the U.S. is doing in this conflict. But the U.S. government is out with its own very recently, just last week, saying that the number of terrorist incidents and deaths has increased exponentially in the last 3 years. So how are we doing in the battle with Al-Qaeda, if it's even right to frame it that way?
Well, it's a good question, Tom. It's almost impossible to quantify, and one of the reasons the report from the State Department that was issued last week has exponentially higher numbers is because they started counting them differently. You know, myself and some other reporters over the past few years have been very critical of the State Department for not including some things like the Chechnya conflict, for not including attacks in Iraq, and for even not including assassination attempts against a Pakistani president, Pervez Musharraf, because they were not considered international acts of terrorism, which was the benchmark that they were using. So they're now trying to use a more accurate, objective benchmark to sort of quantify the war on terrorism. So I think what you'll have to do is start looking at it from here on out and see if they go up or down from here. But clearly, you know, though the State Department and the Bush administration in general are taking credit for and saying that we're winning or making a lot of progress in the war on terrorism, there's a lot of troubling anecdotal evidence that we're if not losing the war on terrorism, certainly just staying our ground. I mean, there's a lot of senior al-Qaeda people that are still on the loose, Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri, for instance, Saif al-Adel, their number three, and others in Iran. There's a huge brain trust and operational cadre of al-Qaeda people in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, in Southeast Asia. Obviously South Asia and Africa and elsewhere. So, they certainly have their work cut out for them.
The implication from the Bush administration, sometimes explicitly stated, is that they've busted up the top brain trust or a big chunk of the top, command and control group of al-Qaeda. Does that seem to be the case?
Well, I just spoke with a very, very senior FBI counterterrorism official who's essentially made it his life's work, who retired recently. And that person said that they've only caught two out of the very senior members of Al-Qaeda's Shura Council, which is the board, chairman of the
board of directors.
It depends on who you ask. One of the big problems is that Al-Qaeda has decentralized from a top-down command and control structure being run out of Afghanistan to a very decentralized organization where there's cells all around the world that are operating somewhat autonomously. The State Department report last week made a very good point. They said that one of their big concerns is quote-unquote micro-actors, which are individuals or groups of very, very small, very, very small groups of individuals who are mounting terrorist attacks that, while they won't be on the scale of 9/11, can be very troublesome and very devastating, and they can be very devastating to the economy as well as killing Americans or others here and abroad.
State Department says Al-Qaeda remains a grave threat. You say, Josh Meyer, that it is now, from your reporting, pervasive in Pakistan, right across the border from Afghanistan, where U.S. troops for a while drove it out. Josh, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from St. Andrews, Scotland, Paul Wilkinson. He's professor of international relations at the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University, co-author most recently of Addressing the New International Terrorism. Paul Wilkinson, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello there.
May I just get your response first to the jury's decision on Zacharias Moussaoui in the last 24 hours here in the U.S.? Will the jihadi world be listening, be watching that decision? Will it make a difference one way or another, for good or ill?
I think that it will be observed by the Muslim world, and that's very important, showing that the federal justice system in the United States can function fairly, indeed punctiliously. I think it's impressive, the amount of detail that was brought forward in the case. And I think that the jury's ruling and the sentence were very appropriate when one considers the doubts about the degree of Moussaoui's direct involvement. And I think that internationally that will be recognized, and that is very good for the image of American judicial proceedings. And I think it might encourage the American authorities to turn back to their federal justice system and use it more extensively for dealing with terrorism rather than circumventing the judiciary.
Paul Wilkinson, let me ask you the big question there then. In this battle with terrorists, will it ultimately be won on the battleground of Islamic world public opinion? Or is it, more importantly, a kind of trench-by-trench battle, this killing, that capture, this network disrupted? Where do you see the most important front here? Or are they so intertwined you can't separate them?
Yes, I think your last point is the right one. They are intertwined. The fact is that we're dealing with a transnational phenomenon. Al-Qaeda is able to survive and adapt because it has a presence in well over 60 countries, hides people in major cities, so they melt into their surroundings. Very difficult for the police and the intelligence services to track. And we know that the international community is still not as good as it should be at sharing information and collaborating on intelligence and judicial matters. But I think that we are improving. And I'm not one of those fatalists who believe that we will be unable to deal with this. I think in time, with great effort and improving our intelligence and collaboration, we will be able to unravel this network.
We're looking to you as a kind of neutral third party here to give us an assessment. The U.S. government makes claims about the progress it's making. From your vantage there in Scotland, looking on in the year since 9/11, Has the U.S. government made substantial progress? Has it made the progress you would expect in this conflict? Has it lost ground on balance?
I think it's really a standoff at the moment. It really is difficult to say that we're actually winning. On the evidence, it's quite clear, as Josh pointed out in your earlier interview, but the levels of terrorist attacks are actually going up. The State Department report makes that very clear. The Iraq terrorism figures are particularly worrying because they have escalated enormously. And we know that there is this trend of the new cells being started in many countries, which shows that they're still recruiting. And they're able to use homegrown terrorists, in some cases very small, localized groups, to carry out attacks. And that is a very difficult problem for the police and the intelligence service because these people have no previous record of terrorist involvement. So I would say that we have a huge task to face, particularly in Iraq, where we know that Al-Qaeda longs to establish a more permanent base of activities. They long for a kind of platform in the midst of the Muslim world where they can reach out and mount further operations in neighboring states. So that is the critical struggle, I think. That is how the Al-Qaeda leadership see Iraq at the present time. And that is why it would be so irresponsible for us, the coalition countries, to wash our hands of the problem and say, well, we didn't expect this thing to last as long. It's very expensive. It puts the lives of our servicemen at risk. We're pulling out. If we pulled out, the situation would not only be far worse for the Iraqis, who have shown their desire for a democratic government, it would be worse for the whole international community.
But didn't we create that platform by going in? It wasn't certainly wasn't a major al-Qaeda platform when Saddam Hussein was in charge.
Well, that's true, and I made that argument at the time, and I've been making it since. Really, the war to topple Saddam was a distraction from the campaign against al-Qaeda because the two were not the same problem. And I think we should have put our priority behind the campaign against al-Qaeda. And we would, I think, by now have probably succeeded in tracking down the core leadership. And that would have been a huge blow. It wouldn't have finished off the al-Qaeda network of networks, but it would have been a huge blow against it.
It sounds like a very different scenario that might have been possible in the absence of an Iraq war, but that's not, as you say, where we sit today. Paul Wilkinson, Josh Meyer, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners into this conversation. Joe is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. My point is that this is a great day in the war on terror, in my opinion. I think that this is a war that I don't want to undercut any part of the military aspect of this war, but I think it's a war about values. And I think what this shows today with the jury ruling is that our juries in this country are able to think rationally using the rule of law and the concepts of the Enlightenment, and basically able to come to rational decisions that are based on law and not be swayed by their undoubtedly very strong emotional reactions against this individual. Again, not to undercut the military aspect, but I think this jury ruling today really shows that Americans are still Americans. The terrorists have not changed the way that we look at life. And I'm really proud to be an American today, and I know that from this jury ruling that we're on great track to defeat what I think is a primitive and barbaric reactionary force, which is embodied in al-Qaeda.
And Joe, do you have any doubt that those, what you call the values of the Enlightenment on display in this sentence, do you have any doubt that those will affect the jihadi community? I mean, that you call primitive and barbaric, are going to be impressed? Are they going to stand down because they say, like, are they going to bow down to the Enlightenment?
Absolutely, Tom. Because what did Massawi want to prove? But he wanted to be executed to prove that we are basically a barbaric society. Because that's what they're trying to prove. This is a war between societies, and you know what Massawi was trying to do, albeit in a very simplistic way, was try to illustrate how awful and uncivilized and barbaric Americans are. And instead, we showed him that we follow the rule of law. We have a value system. We have a complicated society, and that society will persevere. And I think it is a big blow to these people across the world when they read this news and they see how tempered we are.
Yep. Joe, we've got it. Let me put it to our guest, Paul Wilkinson. What do you make of Joe's analysis of the likely impact of this ruling?
I think he's absolutely right. You see, the point is, Tom, we know that we're not going to reach the hearts and minds of the hardcore militants who are full of hatred and venom of the kind that Massawi revealed in his outburst in court. But what we may reach, and this is what we have to aim at, is that big audience of young Muslims who are the people that al-Qaeda is trying to recruit to tempt into their extremist movement and to volunteer for suicide bombing. If we can reduce the number of suicide bomber volunteers for the future, we will have actually begun to defeat this really evil form of international terrorism.
Josh Meyer, as Massawi was sentenced today, I just got this over the wires, he spoke up again, saying, "God save Osama bin Laden, you will never get him," as he was sentenced to life in prison. That fresh from Massawi. Paul Wilkinson says, were it not for the Iraq war, the U.S. might very likely have the top tier of al-Qaeda leadership in custody or dead at this point. Is there consensus around that in Washington, in the security arena? Are people saying to you, maybe we've got to stay in Iraq now, but boy, it cost us a lot in terms of tracking down the leadership here?
Well, yes. I mean, and the way Paul described it was I couldn't say it better myself, but it was very well put. But, you know, I don't think there's a consensus, certainly, that we could have caught Osama bin Laden. But there's clearly a consensus among counterterrorism officials that the war in Iraq was a tremendous distraction. There were many, you know, like Paul, I think that there were many journalists before the war that were pointing out that there was, that the intelligence community didn't believe there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam, and that, you know, if you were going after the Saddam regime to go after al-Qaeda, that it was a huge mistake. And I think that the war, you know, gets increasingly behind us in our rearview mirror, almost a virtual consensus is that this was a mistake, that it really detracted from the war on terrorism, and that we could have made far more significant progress right now. And one of the things that's perhaps the most damaging about this is not even that it was a matter of resources that were distracted and used in Iraq instead of the war on terrorism. One of the bigger problems is that many of our allies, the most important countries in the coalition that we need to win the war on terrorism, are really recoiling in I think in horror at some of the tactics that we've used in Iraq, you know, Abu Ghraib and so on. I mean, I've talked to many counterterrorism officials who say that when they go overseas, the hardest thing they have to do is to convince other countries that, you know, that they can be in a coalition with us. I mean, I think that there's a sense out there that we're not ourselves following the rule of law.
And we've heard again and again that the U.S. cannot do it alone. Josh, we just got you for another minute or two here. What can you tell us about how the structure of al-Qaeda has evolved since 9/11? Just in the last couple of weeks, we've heard from any number on audio tape and videotape of al-Qaeda leaders, Osama bin Laden speaking up, and, of course, voices from Iraq. What's the sort of division of labor now within al-Qaeda? Do we know?
Well, you know, I think that there is a division of labor. It's hard to exactly quantify that as well. But, you know, there's authorities tell me that there's two camps. There's one, a lot of the brain trust of al-Qaeda is now in Iran, of all places, where it's being kept under house arrest of sorts by the Iranian government. And
so in Iran, under the protection of the Iranian government, yes. Or in criminal custody? I guess not.
Well, it's very vague. Nobody really seems to know. I mean, there is no consensus, but a lot of people believe in the intelligence community that these people are being held in some sort of capacity where they cannot plot and plan attacks and issue communiques over the Internet. But Saif al-Adel, who's essentially the number three in al-Qaeda, appears to have done just that last year. So nobody really seems to know what's going on in Iran, except that there's a lot of al-Qaeda people there. One and perhaps three of bin Laden's sons are there, including one who's his heir apparent. You have some of the terrorists who were wanted in the African embassy bombings. But what I think is of more concern is the operational and command structure of al-Qaeda that remains in Pakistan. I mean, I think it's throughout the cities in Pakistan. I think it's in the northwest frontier province where bin Laden and number two Zawahiri are believed to be hiding. I think that they're making strikes into and out of Afghanistan from Pakistan. And I think the Pakistan government, to some degree, is trying to go after them. But I think that, you know, even there we have a problem. I think that there's a lot of sympathy for al-Qaeda and the Taliban in lower ranks of the Pakistan government, and it's a very tough situation over there.
So not just a hideout in that rugged Pakistani terrain, but still a kind of operations center. Josh Meyer, I know we have to let you go. It's been great having you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Josh Meyer, terrorism reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Paul Wilkinson, talked last week from the State Department about micro-actors in the terror world. How does a superpower or a coalition alliance go after micro actors? Great big power going after tiny actors barely connected to a network.
Well, it is extremely difficult, but there are connections that one can follow, and the main ones are ideological and propaganda connections, because even though these small localized cells don't have to go to Afghanistan or to any particular country to be trained. They can be inducted through the Internet. They do certainly have to share the general objectives of the al-Qaeda movement. And it's interesting that they rush forward to claim their affiliation to al-Qaeda, and the al-Qaeda core leadership rush forward to claim ownership of their attack. That's happened again and again. For example, in the Madrid and London bombings, you'll recall that there was a tape which included the supposed leader of the suicide bombers in London, along with Zawahiri. And clearly that was planned as a propaganda move by the top people in al-Qaeda. I don't doubt that they see this as part of their loose network of networks, and although they may not be doing the actual planning of operational detail, they are indicating the kind of targets that should be attacked in their view, and they are uttering various recruiting slogans and launching messages designed to stir up support and to gain new recruits for the movement.
So mutually reinforcing at the very least, and it looks like it works. I want to turn to Washington, D.C., and Ambassador James Dobbins. He's director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation, former special envoy for Haiti, Somalia, Bosnia, and Kosovo in the Clinton administration. And after September 11, 2001, he was the Bush administration's first special envoy for Afghanistan. Ambassador Dobbins, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What's your top-level take on how we're doing in this big battle? Off goes Zacharias Moussaoui, but we've got bigger fish to fry. Is the U.S. doing as well as it should? Is it gaining or losing ground in this battle?
I think it's very hard to measure or come to a definitive judgment. And on the one hand, the United States hasn't suffered any more terrorist attacks itself. On the other hand, the latest administration account of terrorist attacks around the world shows them going way up.
And when you look at how the command structure, if we can call it that, of al-Qaeda has evolved over these years, what does it mean that we now have apparently a large base in Iraq, that across the border from Afghanistan you've got now Pakistan, which Josh Myers was saying is pervasively inhabited now by al-Qaeda, and Iran as host in some capacity to some al-Qaeda bigwigs, we're told by Paul Wilkinson. What does that mean about the enemy we're confronting?
Well, I think that the situation has developed in ways that make it difficult to accurately define the enemy we're confronting, because al-Qaeda itself has morphed from a centrally controlled terrorist conspiracy to a federated, franchised, networked, decentralized set of quite separate conspiracies that are linked by ideology and to some degree perhaps by occasional coordination and assistance and financing, but which are quite separate and distinct.
So when you look at the goals then of these distinct elements, are they the same? There's ideology here, but beyond antagonism toward the United States, are there specific goals that are shared by al-Qaeda leadership in, let's say, Pakistan and Iraq or not?
Well, again, one has to be very careful about using labels. There is a group of terrorist conspiracies which have a common a tactic, which is terrorism, which have a common inspiration, which is the holy war or jihad, and which have a common objective, which is the creation of a Muslim caliphate, a religiously oriented government for the entire Muslim world.
Do you think Zarqawi in Iraq shares that particular goal, yes, let's say with Osama bin Laden?
Yes. But that doesn't mean that the Sunni insurgency in Iraq does, and that's where it's important to make the distinction between this global virtual insurgency, if you will, of jihadist extremists, and a couple of dozen Muslim insurgencies around the world which have broad popular support and have absolutely nothing to do with that set of objectives, but which are often collaborating with al-Qaeda because al-Qaeda has offered to support them when no one else will.
CP's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, CP, you're on the air.
No, I just wanted to ask the gentleman from Scotland, if this is a war, what is al-Qaeda's goal? Is it the total destruction of America, or for us to get out of their area and let them solve their own religious problems?
Paul Wilkinson.
They want nothing less than the reordering of the whole of international relations. As the ambassador was saying, they want to organize a pan-Islamist caliphate, which they want to rule all the Muslim peoples of the world. They want to expel American and American allied influence from all parts of the Muslim world. They want to overthrow the existing governments of Muslim countries because they believe that they are apostate regimes which are collaborating with Western countries, trading with them, and making diplomatic agreements with the West, which in their view is anathema. So they want really a total reshaping of international relations, which is why the aims of the movement seem so unrealistic. And one wonders how people can believe this. But if you bear in mind that they believe that God is on their side and that ultimately they will prevail because it's a holy war, even if it takes decades to achieve it, then you begin to realize why they are going on with the determination and fanaticism that we have seen. We shouldn't underestimate that fanaticism and the ability to adapt in the teeth of our very strong response against terrorism. We have a long-term problem. I believe we can ultimately prevail, but it is going to take a multi-pronged, multinational effort to achieve this. No single country, not even the United States with all its power, can achieve this on its own. We have to work together.
James Dobbins, in that case, if you agree with that analysis, do you see this as necessarily a kind of fight to the death? One side must be completely defeated, or is there some kind of room for accord here, or not?
I'm not sure that there's room for accord with Al-Qaeda and its imitators. I think there is room for accord with the Muslim world and with many of the Muslim insurgents that are fighting against their own governments and in some cases seeking autonomy or independence or other political objectives that have nothing to do with a global caliphate. That depends, that will vary from country to country. Is it possible to reach an accommodation with the Sunni insurgents? Is it possible to bring them into the political process in Iraq? Yes, it is possible, and that's exactly what the American administration is trying to do. Is it possible to reach an accord with the Taliban in Afghanistan? Difficult, but perhaps not impossible. Some former Taliban have already been brought into the political process. So I think one needs to make a careful distinction between what is a global syndicated networked conspiracy of jihadist extremists seeking to create a global caliphate. The bad news is that they're hard to locate and are not centrally directed. The good news is that there's not a lot of them, that their goals are wildly unrealistic and are never going to be achieved, and that they don't represent the desires or aspirations of most of the Muslim world, including most Muslim insurgents.
Paul Wilkinson in Scotland says very pointedly that no nation will be able to defeat this network alone, but said earlier that the U.S. is in many respects alone because of disagreement over its approach since 9/11. How do you see, James Dobbins, the amount of cooperation? Are other nations working hard to go after al-Qaeda, or is the U.S. at the moment sort of left hanging out to dry here?
I think our allies in Europe and other parts of the world are cooperating fairly well with us in terms of police and intelligence exchange. I think most governments in the world believe it was a mistake to have gone into Iraq. They don't believe that Iraq had any meaningful connections with al-Qaeda, something which our own 9/11 commission also concluded. They believe that it has created a new and unnecessary battleground and a recruiting field for al-Qaeda, and that it has bogged down America and made America less capable of addressing what others consider more critical problems in this regard.
Let me turn to our caller, Blake, in Washington, D.C. Hi, Blake. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing? I'm really enjoying your program. It's nice to have the guests really talking about the big picture issues instead of the narrow ones.
Yeah, we try, Blake. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's really good. The biggest problem I had in the comment that I wanted to make was too often what we do is Americans, they want quick results. They want to see something now, because of the 24-hour news cycle, and I think the media contributes to that. And it's going to be a long fight. I just got back from Afghanistan last fall.
In what capacity, Blake?
I was an infantry officer.
Okay, infantry in the Army National Guard.
Army National Guard, Virginia Army National Guard.
I mean, it will be in not too many months, 5 years since 9/11. That doesn't seem like such a short period of time.
Well, except when you think about what it takes to build the nation, whether we're in nation building or not. I mean, I think about Bosnia. I served in Bosnia as well, and I remember when we went in there in, I guess, 95, it was going to be for just a year, and now we're at a point where we're fully drawing down in Bosnia, still having problems in Kosovo, but they've got a working government. They're not, they're not massacring each other and things like that, and I think that's a similar kind of situation we're going to have in Afghanistan. You know, when you looked at what happened with us, my unit in Afghanistan, day to day, you may not have, you saw little things, you may not have seen great changes. But when we looked at what we accomplished over the course of a year, it was, you know, it was a tremendous effect. We'd built great relationships with, you know, with government entities and with the Afghan National Army. And a lot of people, you know, don't see that when they look at day-to-day numbers, day-to-day body count, day-to-day, you know, suicide bombings.
On the other hand, if, as a number of our guests have said, Iraq was a great distraction, that's a pretty monumental distraction. But we take your point, Blake, and we're happy to have it. Thank you for your call. Let me turn to Fairfax, Virginia, and Wahid. Wahid, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'm actually Afghan-American, and I've been to Afghanistan already a couple of times, and I think the United States and the coalition forces has lost the momentum, because when I went in 2002 and 2003, things were getting much better, and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda was losing the battles, and I mean, Afghanistan was pretty much peaceful. But nowadays, I think because the pressure on the Pakistani government has been loosened, and the Pakistani government are start supporting again the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and the training camps still exist in Pakistan. And I think the United States needs to put more pressure on Pakistani government to stop it. And as an Afghan, I mean, I know much better than a lot of people, because the situation in Afghanistan was much better like 2 years ago, but right now still things are getting worse and worse every day, because the Pakistanis are the United States and the coalition force has lost the momentum.
There. So there's an Afghan-American concern that there's slippage on the Afghanistan front. Let me get one more call here from Jacksonville, Florida. Bill's on the line. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello, Bill.
Hey, I thought I'd like to point out that this is a Cowie getting life sentence was probably a big plus for America. That actually it's not going to help anybody stopping from becoming a terrorist, but what it's going to do is take one away one of the teeth, so that they have less cause for their political views, because this terrorism that we're fighting isn't against people, it's against politics and ideas, and we got people trying to use rationing means that are irrational to accomplish this point.
So you're saying that Mousavi verdict may be a win for the United States in that battle of politics and ideas. Our time is running down. Paul Wilkinson, a final thought from you on where we stand today and what's needed next.
Well, I was very encouraged by Ambassador James's analysis, and I think I would just add to his encouraging points the fact that the Al-Qaeda movement has made the great blunder of miscalculating the effect of its ruthless atrocities on their own co-religionists. What is obviously happening in Iraq on a big scale, but we've seen it to some extent in Indonesia, in Turkey, in Morocco, and elsewhere, is they are alienating the people that they claim to be championing. And what happens then is that the people ask their governments to take stronger measures against the Al-Qaeda extremists. So I think that they have made a fundamental blunder, and that will help in the business of unraveling the Al-Qaeda network in the long run.
We just lost Ambassador James Dobbins, but you're seeing something encouraging there in a kind of visceral rejection of the extreme of Iraq. In that sense, Iraq could come to stand for overreach on the part of the many suicide bombers who have shown themselves there.
Yes, that's right. Yes, they may, in fact, have shot themselves in the foot by continuing to wage such dreadful violence against, for example, holy shrines, against funeral processions even, against public places where they know there are going to be crowds of civilians, including women and children. That has horrified hundreds and thousands of Muslims in Iraq and further afield.
Of course, that horror, that revulsion, will need somewhere productive to flow. Paul Wilkinson at the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University in Scotland. Mr. Wilkinson, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And our thanks as well to Ambassador James Dobbins and all our guests who joined us earlier. Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.